This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Cottage Lake Soliloquy. And the author is John Shepherd, and John joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this segment brought to you by Trafford Publishing. Hello, John.
Hello.
Good to have you with us, John. Now, I would like to read a couple of things you've written about your book, just to set the stage for our discussion. You say this, Cottage Lake Soliloquy is a guide to spiritual enlightenment in the form of a novel. It's primarily a tale of transformation about a year in the lives of two people, husband and wife, as they confront personal and professional challenges with their children on a lake in the woods in a small northwest town. I guess thus, Cottage Lake. It's a real place?
Yes, yes, it is. So the name of the town in this is fictitious, and that's Forestville.
Right, and this novel with spiritual enlightenment, very different, obviously, than most novels, based on your experiences?
Yes, culmination of about, maybe 30 years of experiences, actually.
What is your profession?
It's called a psychotherapist in private practice.
Psychotherapist, okay.
Mm-hmm, the last three decades here.
So what the drive to do this because of your profession, because of all the different stories you've come across?
Yeah, I think that's true. The drive to find a sort of unifying element or theme that would serve as a sort of bedrock principle to offer to people about the nature of the situation they're in, whatever they bring me, and I get all kinds of problems, all kinds of issues, but there are underlying principles which this was meant to elucidate, to bring out, and to bring out into bold relief in terms of the various counseling sessions and problems, including the life problems of the main character and his wife and his children as well.
Now, you would classify your book as spiritual, not necessarily religious.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't really have anything to do with religion, just the nature of the underlying spiritual principles of life, of living.
Because we are the dual being.
Yes, you could say that. That's right. Got a spirit and a body, as I say, temporarily.
Right. Well, let's talk about the main characters. Let's start with Jay. Tell us about Jay.
Okay, well, Jay is a psychotherapist in private practice, and he starts experiencing a sudden decline in his formerly successful practice of 14 years by refusing to join the newly established managed care networks, which were ushered in the early 90s. These were created by insurance companies to lower their costs and maximize their profits through tighter regulation of the treatment of patients. And the shift to managed care entailed limiting patient visits and lowering therapist pay and requiring greater paperwork from therapists. And Jay is opposed to these changes. He's somewhat stubborn, having been successful. And so given his unwillingness to join these networks, he finds he's no longer eligible to receive the insurance reimbursements that he was living on. In effect, the mainstay of his income, psychotherapy, is pretty much based on insurance. And so his opposition to the networks causes many clients, prospective clients, to seek treatment elsewhere, since most of them have insurance to cover the cost of therapy. So to bolster his sagging income, he joins his wife's company on a part-time basis. She is the head of a student exchange organization, a burgeoning one, a growing one, a budding one, but it's making contacts throughout the world. It's going fast. So he joins her, and there he encounters more challenges in the form of co-workers in their home-operated business, and various demanding overseas partners he encounters. He tends to lean on alcohol and drugs to offset his distress and fear and frustration. As he approaches financial ruin in his practice, he seeks the counsel of a psychic who was recommended by a friend. And this is all done through the telephone, and through weekly conversations with this mentor, Jay learns a spiritual approach to problem with his business, as well as the general matter of living, you might say. And he eventually integrates the principles he learns, the ideas he learns of into his practice, passing them along to his clients. And by the end of a year's time, which is what the novel the length of the novel encompasses. His personal and professional lives have undergone a significant, happy, and lasting transformation.
And a transformation, it sounds like, in Jay himself, from the intellectual to the spiritual.
Yeah, exactly. That's right, exactly. So he learns essentially that peace of mind is the foundational underpinning, has a perspective for all things. There's other principles such as the nature of life is supportive if you're being true to yourself. And the way to be true to yourself is to constantly choose peace of mind irrespective of your circumstances, to then see what you feel inclined or moved to do. You might say as the movement of life is moving through you, intuitively, you might say, giving you a sense of guidance as to what's the next best thing to do at any given time.
Now, what kind of a relationship does he have with his wife?
Well, it's a good relationship. Basically, they love each other very much, but there's a lot of stresses that both of them are experiencing in raising the children, maintaining the property, and primarily running their own businesses. And so she basically, though, her stresses come more from her world. She has challenges in her work, which encompass trickery and fraud from competitors and employees. Well, she's attempting to manage and grow a burgeoning international business from an office in her home. And foreign travel and excessive business demands estrange her a lot from her family and keep her on the road. All personal matters, including the death of loved ones, sibling rivalry, and the apparent peril of infidelity, combine to plague her private life as well. So the demands of her booming but fledgling enterprise until travel to Vienna for a large convention with potential new associates and menacing rivals, and a journey to Japan to deal with severe and exacting business partners, a trip to Toronto to investigate possible embezzlement, and a visit to Pittsburgh to unravel bitter and complicated knots in her relationships with her two sisters. She eventually seeks counsel from Leroy as well and begins to learn. Leroy is the name of the psychic, if I didn't mention that. And starts to deal successfully with the issues that are threatening to destroy her livelihood, her relationships, her peace of mind. So during the course of the 12 months that chronicle the tale, she has harried and varied encounters with foreign colleagues, difficult subordinates, family members, not so much with her husband, but some. But eventually, through persistence, faith, she pulls her professional and private lives back from the brink of disaster and, like Jay, emerges a wiser, happier, and more powerfully loving presence.
Well, it sounds like you're really focusing on real-life problems and challenges, real-life characters.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, especially in the context of the practice, the psychotherapeutic practice, which keeps going. There are a great deal of subordinate characters that come in to play that have their own issues, very dramatic issues for them, very poignant, intense issues in many cases, covering the gamut that you might see in a practice. So there's a lot of real issues that are shown in the context of the counseling sessions as well. It's just what the two main characters go through.
Now, how much do the children play a part in this main plot of the story?
It's a good question. They're basically, if you had to give it a percentage, it might be like 20%. There's about 80-some chapters in this, and they go back.
This is a long book, folks, but it's well worth the journey.
Yeah, thank you. It's about 700 pages. It's thick. And the chapters go back and forth with a chapter on J, chapter on B, chapter on J, chapter on B, back forth. And then every once in a while, it comes down to there's eight chapters on the children, four on each, which are sort of deftly inserted along the way every so many chapters, so it's sort of balanced picture. And one of them is the older one's graduating from college and getting married, and the other one's just entering high school. So it has to do with the various challenges the two of them encounter in those contexts today.
And are they willing to listen to this new spiritual enlightenment that mom and dad have?
That's a good question. No, they may more deal a little bit. The older ones a little more amenable to it. But more they just deal with things on their own experiential level. The young ones in high school, and it wouldn't make much sense for him to be meditating and so forth with respect to the problems he encounters, drugs, girls, grades, bullies, different people in school. So perhaps it seeps in through by example, and that's probably when the best teaching is done. As mom and dad get better and the tensions in their lives subside and turn into solutions, the kids start to experience almost by osmosis a sense of their lives getting better as well. But they don't directly encounter, just a little bit. Actually, there's a little bit where each of them have something to do with the teacher, Leroy, in a minor way. Let's say they're aware of it.
How many clients are part of the story?
I think it's about a dozen clients, each with a distinctly different...
Give us an example of, a couple of the different challenges that they're facing.
Sure. Let's see. Well, there's one. It's an interracial couple, a black woman and a white man, and they're married and they have four kids. They're under tremendous pressure just to make their life work. That one focuses a lot on communication. I try to use different themes, such as dealing with loss, someone loses someone they love, dealing with anger, someone has consistent anger outbursts. There's two distinct stories of people who have betrayal, infidelity in their marriage, which rips them apart, so the grief. Some are dealing with depression, and some are just plain anxious, but all of them can find, ultimately, some solace, some sense in getting united with a spiritual perspective as a foundation, and then making choices from that perspective to change their life for the better.
Well, it sounds like it has a happy ending.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. The idea is that this works. This stuff works.
I mean, we're talking about the human condition, but at the same time, because of the wise man, the psychic, Leroy, and his teaching, I guess mainly Jay, does B also listen to him, or is it mainly Jay?
Jay's primarily the one. It's a series of conversations that are taped by the psychic when they have them, just like we're taping this, and then those tapes are mailed to Jay, and he plays them back, whether he's jogging or whether he's in the car or whether he's just relaxing somewhere in his office. And so that's part of the format of the story, where you have the back-and-forth dialogue in a taped version being given.
So these spiritual ideas, these spiritual guidelines, would you say they're based on true principles?
Yeah, I think so, though I think they sound right to most people, but I think ultimately you need to have results through using them to feel convinced that they're realistic. And I found them to be, and that was the point of which I was motivated to write this, to share this with people.
So there's resolution in the lives of not only Jay and B and children, but also these clients.
Absolutely, yes. Though it's not all a nice little tidy, neat package with respect to the clients. It's pretty realistic there about how things go through phases. Some things are getting better, but the actual sense of resolution is based on the four characters of the book, the family themselves. That's where you get a sense of there was a problem, it spiked, essentially it met resolution and came back down. While the clients, they may vary quite a bit. Some of theirs are still ongoing at the book's end, though you get a sense that these principles work, that they're going to be applied, and that things could well work out.
I'd like to also add, and you can make a comment, we just have a little bit of time left, that your writing style brings to life the serenity of this cottage lake of environment. That's what I felt. You kind of brought it to life the way you write about it. I had pictures, so you're very good at that. It's not just a bunch of conversations with people.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I think I put a lot into trying to give a sort of lyrical and lush description of nature as you experience it through the four seasons, which this encompasses. Because, frankly, it along with the principles learned from this wise man, this psychic, this mentor, the other inspirational thing that drove me to write this book, inspired me to write this book, was just the simple beauty of the lake. It has almost spiritual healing quality in and of itself, simply being on water. And I basically tell, I draw from real life when I tell the story of how J and B, the protagonists, eventually found this lake. They were essentially out looking for property on water and got lost, quote-unquote, and they didn't like any of the properties they'd seen, and Jay had meditated before they left, saying, in effect, to God or the powers that be, where do you want me? You know, I want to be on water. Put me where you want me. And they end up lost on a dead-end street, and they turn around, and they find this beautiful place. So
that's wonderful.
Yeah. It's nice. It dovetails nicely into the nature of the truth of the matter. If you want to be true to yourself, if you give it to God, if you do that which you feel moved to do, somehow the nature of life will be supportive and things will work out one way or another satisfactorily.
The author is John Shepherd. The title of his book, Cottage Lake Soliloquy. And John, tell us how to get your book.
Basically, you just can Google Cottage Lake Soliloquy, and it will come up through Barnes & Noble or through Amazon or through a number of other dealers that will carry it. Or you could buy it direct from Trafford. But I find that Googling brings it up very quickly. Cottage Lake Soliloquy will do it. There's not that many of them around.
Well, John, thanks for being on Indie Book Publishing.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
This special segment of Indie Book Publishing brought to you by Trafford Publishing.
Listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready for the Not So Soccer Mom Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central on TogiNet with Jill Hickey. You name it, from politics to pop culture to Jill's search for the perfect bronzer and chicken salad. The Not So Soccer Mom will weigh in on it all. The sentence, "I have no opinion about that," is one that Jill has never uttered. In the early 90s, Jill finally decided to put her thoughts, opinions, mom advice, love of pop culture, hummus, and Starbucks, working out, cosmetic shopping, and politics into an actual website, and thus NotSoSoccerMom.com was born. Shortly after her fourth child, a boy, Jerome, now she's really got tons of topics to share with you. This is Laugh Out Loud Funny, and we're not kidding. What's a loud Nebraska girl who lived in Little Rock for many years and now is up in the Northeast doing? Chronicling her opinions on everything. The wheels aren't off yet, but it's close. It's the Not-So-Soccer Mom with Jill Hickey, Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central, on TogiNet.com. Innovation and insight. Problems and solutions. Capitalizing on your ideas and efforts. That's all a part of Changing the World One Invention at a Time with Rick Rowe. Thursday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. Rick will be sharing stories of innovation, invention, inspiration, and overcoming obstacles with guests who have been there, done that, and are doing that. Rick will be asking the right questions, helping you identify the real problems, and showing you how to act on your ideas by increasing consumer confidence, and more importantly, increasing your confidence to act on your ideas. For even more information, go to ThinkTech, that's T-E-K, globally.com. Then join us as Rick and his guests teach us how to develop new ideas and create new products, new businesses, new jobs. And together, let's get our economy growing again. It's Changing the World One Invention at a Time with author and inventor Rick Rowe. Thursday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Undruggist, Book 1, A Tale of Modern Apothecary and Wellness. And the author is Larry J. Frieders. And this Indie Book Publishing segment is brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Steve. How are you this afternoon?
Well, we're going to learn a lot about all those drugs that are advertised and all the many, many prescriptions that especially people over 60 are prescribed. It's as you put it, it's just out of hand. But you've come a long way through the years and learned a lot as a pharmacist. I want to read a couple of things you've written, though, just to set the stage. You say this: "The Undruggist is a simple story in many parts that supports the idea that we are made well and that we can stay that way without drugs, surgery, or radiation therapies." You also want the reader to understand that our bodies were either made improperly or we have done things to damage them, and drugs and chemicals are dumped by the ton into water supplies. We were designed to operate most efficiently without toxins, and using modern treatment only adds to the toxin burden our bodies must bear. So regardless of all the harmful forces at work, it is still possible to do a better job, and it may take some time and effort, but the outcomes are superior. So there's more than one way to get help, I guess, that medical help. Too many of us just run to the doctor for another drug. Larry, tell us kind of about your background and how your view of things was established and how you see some things today.
I started back in the 1960s, a long time ago. With friends of the family were pharmacists, and my father thought that was a wonderful career. It was a nice, quiet job in a clean environment, and it was exciting on some levels because back in those days we made things, you know, put capsules together and mixed liquids, and that was one of my interest was chemistry kits and things of that nature. So I went off to pharmacy school and graduated in 1971. And the business that I entered, a county hospital, a couple other places, they really fulfilled my needs, and I was part of the health team. I was helping doctors and nurses and getting medications to the patients, and it was quite fulfilling. And somewhere in the 70s and 80s, the number of available drugs in prepackaged units became larger and larger, and the need to do the compounded things or the specialty things kind of started to fall by the wayside. And I looked at other opportunities in healthcare, and I picked up an MBA at Northwestern University back in the mid-70s, and with the hope of kind of getting myself into one of the management career tracks at a hospital or a large company of some kind or another. And that worked. It worked really well. I ended up moving from Cook County Hospital to a smaller hospital in the south side of Chicago. But I was the director of pharmacy, and then I became the director of pharmacy and central services, which was the department that did sterile processing. And after about 7 or 8 years, I got the urge to do my own thing, to be in the retail business, to be face-to-face with people. And I opened a small drugstore in my hometown. I was part of a chain of franchises called The Medicine Shop. And that went really well. I had a really good time. And again, was face-to-face working with people. And a few years after we started it, though, my wife and I got the idea of doing the home infusion type business, where we would do IV fluids and pretty high-tech stuff in people's homes. We both of my wife's a pharmacist and I'm a pharmacist. We both had experience in the hospitals making these things, and we worked together with some other people and got into that business. And along the way, I became interested in medical ethics because some of the issues we discussed were end-of-life issues. People who were in extreme pain, they said, I want to die. And those questions kept popping up, is this right or wrong or what's going on? So I went off to Loyola University in Chicago, picked up a degree in philosophy, a master's degree, and my specialty was medical ethics. And I haven't done much with it on a professional basis, even though I was an ethicist on a couple committees at some local hospitals. But that shifted my focus from that of being pure scientist, which I think I was as a pharmacist. Do this, get that, add this to that, and you get so-and-so. You mix two chemicals, it turns purple, et cetera. You know, the standard scientific laboratory approach to things. But then I began to wonder if all of this was necessary. And it wasn't too much after the degree was finished in the mid to late 90s that I started to notice people using certain medications and not using them repeatedly, especially things for hormones like thyroid or women's estrogens. I saw them pick up their prescriptions, and then a month or two later they might get a refill, but then they wouldn't get it. And the comments were always, well, I felt worse using it. And that caused me to kind of question what I was doing, selling things that make people feel worse and have an uncomfortable life. And so we decided to start moving away from that, and we ended up here where I am now as the compounder. And that's all we do, is we sell compounded medicines that are custom-made for people, and we don't do the standard prescription drug-type things, where you can go to a regular large drugstore and they crank out a label, pump, count some pills, put them in a bottle. Those are necessary functions for a lot of people, but it wasn't something that was fulfilling for us. And so we've gotten into this other line of work. So the more I've done things without drugs, the more people that have come in and talked to me, and I've seen them get improvements in their life and their health without drugs or surgery or radiation, the more it began to dawn on me that my philosophy had to change as far as what it meant to be healthy and to live a long life. And then my daughter, who's a grown daughter, and she works with us here at the store, she said one day, could you put all that together in one place? You know, we've got a website, we've got a Facebook account, like most people do, but she wanted something that would outline my philosophy towards health. And it was her idea and her suggestion that got me to pen this book the first time out. And I called it Book One because I hope it is. I hope there's something that comes after this. Not exactly sure how that will work out. It's only been a couple months since this one's been finished, but I've got some ideas and see where it goes.
Well, you say that too many people take too many drugs, and nobody can possibly care about your health as much as you do. So the two of those are in conflict, aren't they?
It does sound that way, doesn't it? Too many people do take too many drugs. Just a quick story. When I was back in school, back in the last century, people who took three drugs simultaneously were considered to be at a pretty high risk for a drug interaction, possibly as high as 80%. And when the number of drugs increased to five at a time, those people's risk levels climbed close to 100% as far as a risk for a side effect, a bad side effect. In fact, when I worked at Cook County Hospital in Chicago, when people came in and they were taking four or five or more different medications, they would contact our pharmacy department and say, take a look at this and let's see what's going on. And I think they had two motivations. One was, of course, the altruistic one is, do they really need five or six different drugs? The other question that used to pop up around it was, is the Cook County Hospital in Chicago paid for the medications that they gave to people. So there was an economic incentive on that issue. Should we pay for six different medications when they only need two or three? And so that got me thinking. And in those days, that was pretty common, three, four drugs per year for the older or the sicker of the population. And recent studies have shown that the average person, I mean average from the age of 18 to 60, they're taking somewhere in the area between 11 and 15 different medicines per year, most of them simultaneously. And after the age of 60, the number could rise to 20 or 30 per year. Now, if three was a risk, you can imagine what the risk really is when it's at 10 or 15 different drugs being taken. So there's something to be concerned about there. And so my concern in putting this all together was, is that without thinking, a lot of us are taking too many drugs. And it's not because people are eager to make us ill or unhealthy. It's just that we're using the health system to such a degree that the people we're depending on to help us can't possibly care as much about us individually as we do ourselves. Doctors are inundated with people. They're very, very busy. They see hundreds or thousands of people a month. It's not physically possible for that doctor to really care about you. Now, of course, the doctor is a caring person. Wouldn't be in that profession if he or she wasn't. But the reality is, for personal attention to your needs or my needs, they just can't do it. You add up those hours, and there's not enough hours in a month for somebody to really spend time with you, so that the responsibility rests on your own personal shoulders. You need to come at it from that perspective. That's my idea. I'm in charge of my health. I look to other people for assistance, and I will make the decisions on whether their recommendations are appropriate or not. And when somebody takes the position of adding yet another drug to cover up the symptoms from the one you were taking last week. I think that the problem is clear and you need to do something about it, namely say no to some of those new prescriptions.
You remember your father saying to you when something had made you feel ill or something hurt, you'd say your dad would look at what hurt, make sure it wasn't broken, bleeding, or inflamed, and tell you to watch it for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And today, of course, we'd race to the doctor.
Yep, we race there very quickly, and we've got emergency rooms and urgent care centers. And my dad started that thought process with me, but years later, I was playing volleyball, and I had hard contact lenses, and I was spiked right in the face. And that lens went flying, and my eye turned bright red. The next morning, the eye doctor says, oh, there's no real damage. It looks pretty bad, but you'll be fine in 10 days. And sure enough, I was. And I saw that doctor at a dinner party one night, and I says, Doc, how the heck did you know that it would be fine in 10 days? And he says, it's always 10 days. The point I think he was making, and that I've used as part of my philosophy for health over the years, is if I have a rash when I wake up on Monday morning, it's probably not reasonable to run to the doctor that morning or that afternoon. It's more likely that something has irritated the skin and it's going to get better. Now, if on the other hand, if it continues to get worse, then maybe it makes sense to go talk to someone. I set a limit at 10 days. If things haven't gotten better or if they're getting worse over a 10-day period, that's when you want to talk to somebody and get some assistance. But for the most part, our bodies take care of us. I'm sure you've probably heard the old joke that they used to tell when you go to the doctor for a cold, and they would say, well, if you don't do anything, it's going to take 7 days for you to feel better, but I can give you a prescription, and it's going to take a week. And this is where we've given up our own personal responsibility for our own health, and we've turned it over to people who can't care.
Well, you point out, and I think everyone would agree, that the environment is more toxic every day. It's becoming that way. So proper living, as you put it, is vital.
It's very important, and it's very difficult to accomplish. It takes constant vigilance. The water supply is being damaged. We've always talked about that. But there are many elements in the environment that act like estrogens in our body. Estrogen is a female hormone. It's sometimes referred to as the proliferative hormone, the one that makes tissue grow. It's what makes women rounder and men more angular, because men have far less of it. But it causes tissue to grow, expand, etc. And I'm convinced, and I agree with the studies that show that estrogen, all levels of estrogen, might be at the root or the basis for what causes cancer. Well, that would be one issue to say, well, let's avoid too much estrogen. The problem is that there are chemicals in the environment that act like estrogen in the body. The plasticizers, you hear people talking all the time about plastic bottles or the things that are in baby bottles or whatever. They act like estrogens when they get in our body. Another category would be pesticides. You know, a lot of the stuff that they spray on the fields, we have the assumption that they're killing bugs. But in reality, what they're doing is they're like an estrogenic substance. They make the mama bug sterile. And bugs have short lifespans, so you got a bunch of sterile mama bugs. They don't have baby bugs, and now the bugs aren't bothering the plants. But that chemical that they used is an estrogenic-type substance, and it has estrogen activity in the human body as well. And they're usually in an oily substance. They're on the surface of the plants. They're in an oil base. They don't wash off right away. And so what do? We consume them. And some of the stuff that washes off ends up in the water. So then we drink it. And a lot of these synthetic things act like this, but they don't break down in the environment. So they're there, and they start accumulating. So the more times you spray the field, the more times you throw the plastic bottles away, the more often that you put the plastic dish in the microwave, all these things are adding to the toxic load, and the toxic load usually has a nature of estrogen. So we have to find ways to avoid those substances. Purified water, filtered water, distilled water, organic food, meats that have been grown in organic, on animals that have been fed organic grasses instead of grains that have been contaminated. It takes an effort. But when you make that effort, and you are looking for the things that might be toxic and trying to avoid them, you're doing yourself a great favor. You feel better and you live longer. And on top of everything else, you got all these toxic artificial sweeteners out there. They act by messing with our brains, and I could go into a whole article or discussion of that. But chemicals are a bane to our future and our healthy living, and if we work hard at it, we can avoid them.
Well, your book is broken down into many chapters. You cover home remedies and common sense, as you call it. You talk about bad breath. You talk about urinary tract infections. You talk about throat, where your throat hurts. And of course, there must be something wrong with the scale. We couldn't possibly be that heavy. And healthy choices. Let's just finish on this idea, and it caught my attention because when you think of the word disease, boy, that really makes you feel uncomfortable and you know, very serious and sounds like such an extreme thing. But when you break down that word like you did, dis-ease, it's an interruption of the normal. So we have to look at this whole thing differently, don't we?
We absolutely do. It's not that we're being attacked from the outside all the time. Sometimes our dis-ease comes from the inside. And if we maintain that dis-ease, we can get really sick. We can actually interfere with our future and our healthy living. So there's something that goes into this that we need to be constantly aware of it. I'm sorry that our lives are a little bit more complicated than we'd like them to be, but the fact of the matter is, if we don't pay attention and if we don't take action, we will not be at ease with our health and our life, and that will impact everything. If you're not feeling well, if you got headaches, if you're bloated, you go on and on with all these things that we then look for drugs to cure. The fact that you've got hyperacidity, which is what some people call that, I just totally disagree with the whole concept of GERD and using drugs to treat it. But think of how you feel if you've got heartburn all the time. How could you be socially
right
well off and have a good time with your family? You know, so I can understand how people want to become more at ease, but the methods we're using...
Taking another drug is not the answer.
Absolutely. You've got that. I'm glad you're listening.
Yeah.
I'm glad you read my book.
Yes. Well, Larry, we appreciate you being with us. Tell us how to get your book.
Okay. You can get the book by going to my website. Or the best thing to do is Balboa Press. I mean, they've got it for sale there, BALBOA.com. They've got the book. Amazon sells it. That's kind of an interesting thing. I was glad to see them pick it up. And we've got some here in the store. If you want to go to thecompounder.com, click on our little store thing, and there's a place where you can buy the book. So it's not available in all the major book chains.
But you can ask for it.
You can ask for it, and they'll get it.
Right. And the title of the book... The Undruggist, Book One, A Tale of Modern Apothecary and Wellness. And the author is Larry Frieders. Thanks, Larry.
All right, Steve. Thanks for calling.
This special segment of Indie Book Press is brought to you by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski. A live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com.
Look who's on, it's Dakota McKeith, and he's number one. Now you might think one Bill's youth was sad, right? Cause he had a deaf, ear, mommy, and dad, right? But that ain't the case, nope. It wasn't his fate, nope. The Walls never struggled to communicate, ha. Y'all wave your hands, look who's on, yep. It's Dakota Man Keith, and he's number one.
It's That Keith Wan Show on TogiNet.com, Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central. Every week, That Keith Wan Show will have guests that share their experiences, expertise, opinions, and personal lives with us to hopefully help us better understand others. The topics and guests will come from the American Sign Language community. For more on Keith Wan and the show, go to his website, KeithWan.com. Listen with an open mind and willingness to learn and help with the cultural bridge.
Number one, Keith's number one. Everybody clap because Dakota Man's on. Number one, Keith's number one. Everybody clap because Dakota Man's on.
Don't miss That Keith Wan Show, Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Your Must, Your Purpose in Life. And the author is Dr. Rochelle Carr Burns. And Dr. Burns joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this segment brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Dr. Burns.
Hello, and how are you?
I love it. Your must. We have got to understand this, what it means, especially the word must. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, give us a little of your background, your professional experience, your studies. What's brought you to this point?
First of all, I got my doctorate as what they call a mid-career adult, so I went back to university, and I am a social historian. I got it in the interdisciplinary areas of American history, family, and values. I look to the past human behavior. I look only to the good guys and good women, and I see how they handled specifically relationships. And I figure if they went through it, let us at least make a shortcut and learn from them, tweak it to our present circumstances, and use the knowledge that they gained. That's my purpose as a social historian. I've done many things. I've been a teacher in inner city and at a college. I founded the Books Are Friends. I've given away over 5,000 books to children of the working poor in a variety of places, Indian orphanages and so on. I've been a cable television interviewer. I've been on a gazillion boards, including two universities. In 2002, I was awarded Woman of Excellence for my achievements and for my volunteerism. And last year, actually, my husband and I, because of what we've done throughout our lives, we were actually presented to Queen Elizabeth at St. James Palace. So that was an ooh-ah moment.
Wow, congratulations.
And, yes. Thank you. It was a lot of fun. Great lady, works hard. And I've also been a judge of the Citizenship Court of Canada. So I've met people from all over the world. And I started volunteering when I was a teenager at a hospital because I was terrified of hospitals. I thought I would get over this. I never got over the fear of hospitals, but I learned a lot. In the nursery, I would see newborns, even twins, and there was something about them that was always different. It was as if there was a thread within them. And I started to see that that thread follows these people throughout their entire lives. And that is what this book is about. It's about the thread that's within you from the moment you are born, and it follows you no matter what you do. And if you follow that thread, that's where you get the joy in life, and also, most important, that's where you feel needed in life.
Well, in summary, you say this, this written statement, your must, throughout your life you feel a particular deep sense that seems to be pulling you towards something special. That something special does not depend on external circumstances. That something special is mutually beneficial to you and society. That something special is your purpose for being here. It is your must. Wow, I love that. I just love that. Let's define must. This is a very important word throughout your book.
Absolutely, and that's why I put it in a capital M throughout the book, and I used it as a noun. I put it in a different context. It's invented, the term is new, but the reality of MUS is as old as history. And in the book, I actually show how it's people who follow their MUS who actually have brought us to this place now. And no matter what goes on in the world today, I know there's revolutions and there's slave trade and there's all kinds of things going on in the world that are still horrendous, but it's a heck of a lot better living here now than it would have been for any of us, especially if you're a woman, say living in the Middle Ages. So we have made progress, and I have shown throughout the book by using examples from historic figures and also what I call the I know sections. I put that in italics because these are people I have met throughout my life, and I've met ambassadors, I have met people, custodians who clean schools, I have met the gamut. And these people also seem to have a thread that goes through their life, that when they follow the thread, it doesn't mean that that becoming an ambassador is your must. What it really means is that you can use the role of being an ambassador or use the role of being the best cherry pie maker. You use that role to follow what is your purpose in life. And your purpose has twofold. It must make you happy, and it must be beneficial to society. So if some terrorist lobs his negatives into a crowd and tries to say, oh, you know, I was forced to do this, it's my purpose in life. No, it's not. It's an egocentric move on his part. A must has to be beneficial to both you and society. And every single person on this planet has a purpose for being here.
I want to repeat that. Everyone on this planet has a purpose for being here. Now, a lot of people don't believe that.
True. Because I think they're getting so caught up in negatives. And also, I think what they're getting caught up is in comparing themselves to others. If you focus on yourself, for instance, if you start looking to see within yourself, what is there that attracts you to certain areas in life? What are the words that attract you? What are particular visuals that attract you? A perfect example is Dr. Dorothy Height. She was probably the foremost African-American female in the top ranks of the American Civil Rights Movement for 50, 60 years. When she was a teenager, she read in the Constitution's 13th, 14th, and 15th Reconstruction Amendments about freedoms for African Americans. At the time she was reading this, she saw an ad for a speaking contest. So the winner, she found out, would receive a four-year college scholarship, and she wanted this. She was attracted to the words in these amendments. She went on, won the scholarship, and continued being attracted to these words. It was the words that showed her that no matter what she was going to do in life, it was going to involve dealing with freedoms for African Americans. And so she followed that, and that's what she did. And every single person has this. I give another example of a woman who felt, oh, you know, some of her neighbors, the women run off to these high-profile jobs, and she's not. She's a stay-at-home, and her house is lovely and all the rest. And then one day she was watching a television program, and she was sitting there taking down a recipe. And she realized she was really happy every time she saw something or did something that was homey. She loved baking. She loved looking after children. She loved decorating. That was her must. It gave her joy. All the people, her family, friends who came to the house loved being there because she was following her must. So the point is, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter also where in the world you are. And people ask me, well, what if you're in some totalitarian regime? You certainly, especially if you're a female, you certainly can't follow different things. Well, you can, but you have to be more circumspect about it. You may not be able to be a female artist in many countries in the world, but when you take your children down to the lake to do your washing and it's sunset, you can point out the beauty of the sky, the different colors in the sky. You can show them the different beauty of the mountains. You can teach them how the lines go on the mountains and they change with the setting sun. You don't have to actually put it on a canvas, but you are doing something that gives you joy and the listener joy.
Well, I'm too old or I'm too young. I'm just not ready to do anything.
Okay, that's, there's two parts to that. First of all, we know nobody is too old to learn anymore, and we're being encouraged, and rightly so, because I've always had this belief. First of all, I love learning, always loved school, and I know that life is an entire learning project, and you either are going to get on board and enjoy it, or it's going to keep hitting you over the head because you don't intend to increase your knowledge. But it doesn't matter what your age is. I talk about a man who, he loved music, but a must has to be shared. In Buddhism, it talks about how a candle, if one candle lights many other candles, it doesn't dim the first candle. It actually spreads light. We know it's common sense. So a must that you have must be shared with somebody else in order for it to be fully appreciated, obviously. So this man was in his 70s, whatever, and with going into a senior's home. He had always loved music, but he always listened to it on his own. Now he was in the senior's home, and somehow he got involved with a choir, and he got involved with talking about music. He eventually took over the music section of the senior's home, and his grandson came to visit him. He encouraged his grandson to play the clarinet, and this went on for 8 years until he passed on. The music program at the senior's home continued. Today his son is grown, and his son plays clarinet in a symphony.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I want to read a supporter, a friend, a critic, a reviewer, Kim Maynard, Dr. Kim Maynard, author of Healing Communities in Conflict. She says this, that Dr. Burns passionately illustrates that desire to contribute that underlies our collective humanness. She pulls from the guts, minds, and hearts of those who have brought their purposes to life and inspires the reader to act. Your must is a timely call to the human race to follow that knowing little voice that screams, I can make a difference. This is a must read for every human being. That sums it up. You must be proud of that description of your book.
And even more so, Steve, because I know this woman personally, and she is somebody who is following her must. She actually sent that to the publisher from Afghanistan. She's American, and she's over there. What she does is she heals communities, that towns that have sort of a peace accord on paper. But just because it's on paper doesn't mean the neighbors love each other. So what she does is she tries to bring them together with common interests and so on. So she's an amazing person herself, and she is somebody who definitely is following her must. She is bringing together people who really would not be able to find a way to get together because they've had centuries of hatred distilled into them.
Well, your book is broken into different sections. One is Totality of a Must. The second one is Finding Your Must. Third one, Following Your Must Path. Fourth, Musts and Your Life. And Fifth, Muss and Society. Then there's Muss and Forever History. I love the phrases, the way you've broken this down, the different sections. And they're all, some of them are just, they kind of grab your attention. For example, the must dance is step by step. What does that mean?
First of all, I think that people in Western countries tend to think, if I do one little thing, then everything's supposed to be perfect. The late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, you don't have to see the whole staircase to take the first step. If that's the idea behind it. It's a step-by-step process. And you are also not going to be able to see the ending. You never actually see all the good that you have done for yourself, and certainly not all the good that you have done for society. A perfect example is John Adams. We know what he did starting the nascent United States. He put it on its feet, and he worked really hard, and he knew some of the accomplishments that he did. But we know now that he had no clue what that effort that he put forth has resulted in today, with the United States being this strong, wonderful country that it is, a beautiful example for people around the world. He had no idea that it was going to go this way. And so also, you can know that each step that you take is important, but you don't know where it exactly it's going to end. I have a section in there about what's called the butterfly theory. There was a Professor Lawrence in the 1960s. He actually did this, I believe, for his thesis for his doctorate at MIT. And he talked about how a butterfly with one flap of its wings, we don't know where that little bit of air that moved, where it's going to continue. It might bring a cooling breeze all the way to the Sahara. It might help Canada geese fly a little smoother. We have no idea how it affects. It's the ripple effect in when, you know, kids throw stones on the top of water. It's that kind of idea. You don't know what's going to affect what, but you do know something that's very important. Throughout all of this, you know you are needed on this planet. From the moment you are born, you are needed. And what you do is important. You may not make the headlines, but you make people's hearts feel better.
Dr. Burns, tell us how to get your book.
It's been published by Balboa Press, which is a division of Hay House. You can check all the major bookstores, you know, in Amazon and Barnes & Noble and so on. And you can contact Balboa Press also. You can go onto my website, MinervaRSocrates.com, and there's more information there as well.
Well, thank you, Dr. Burns. Thank you for being with us on Indie Book Publishing, this special segment brought to you by Balboa Press. Thank you very much.
And my pleasure.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.